Welcome to the Federal News Update for Saturday, November 29th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Today we are doing a very deep dive into a single 24-hour cycle, a day that really defined the speed and I think the radical intent of the federal government.
Mm.
Our mission here for you is to go past the headlines and do a real forensic examination of these synchronized activities that kicked off at midnight 00:00 on Friday, November 28th, 2025.
Yeah, and this wasn't just a day of, minor policy adjustments. What we saw was the calculated, almost perfect execution of a pre-existing and very impactful agenda.
And the backdrop is what makes November 28th so significant. It's what our sources are calling a historic demarcation line.
It is. The administration moved on this massive agenda right after the Thanksgiving holiday. They were, it seems, leveraging the national shock, that really intense atmosphere, from the targeted attack near the White House.
The attack that killed U.S. Army Specialist Sarah Beckstrom.
Exactly. And that tragedy, as you said, became the perfect operational window. It wasn't just crisis management.
No, it was the political fuel for what sources are calling a high-velocity implementation phase.
Precisely. We saw the entire administrative state just move in lockstep. It executed what we can really break down into three primary coordinated maneuvers. And these really define the whole strategic intent of the day.
Okay, let's lay those out for everyone because they touch on everything. Security, population, and education. So pillar one, the aggressive dismantling of, established immigration pipelines, all of it done under this new, and I think we have to say radical, third world doctrine.
Right.
Pillar two is the formal, very visible militarization of domestic law enforcement, which was operating under the just rebranded Department of War.
And pillar three, the one that might fly under the radar, but is so important.
The universities.
The universities. The establishment of this incredibly powerful, high cost federal precedent for intervening in higher education, and they did it through aggressive civil rights enforcement.
The strategy tying it all together, what our sources keep coming back to, is the weaponization of the administrative state.
Yes. Every single agency we're going to look at today, justice, state, education, the new Department of War, they all moved as one to achieve ideological compliance and, a kind of national closure.
So we need to go through these actions one by one, the what, the how, and really the why it matters to you.
Let's do it.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We have to start at the core of the crisis, the attack in the Capitol and the immediate militarized response.
Right. The center of gravity for everything that happened politically that day was the confirmed death of U.S. Army Specialist Sarah Beckstrom. Her death gave the administration the moral and emotional high ground it needed to justify this radical escalation.
And Specialist Beckstrom was just 20 years old from Summersville, West Virginia. She was part of the Safe and Beautiful Task Force. Her death just immediately changed the whole equation. It wasn't just a violent assault anymore.
No, it became a federal capital crime. It gave them a martyr figure to rally support, not just for the security agenda, but for the huge crackdown on immigration that followed.
And we should remember, the atmosphere was just electric all day because the second victim, staff JGOT Andrew Wolf, was still in critical condition.
Right. So the crisis felt ongoing. And the Department of Justice, they acted with incredible speed.
U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro.
She moved almost instantly to charge the suspect, Ramal Nola Lakhanwal. He's a 29-year-old Afghan national, was granted asylum just back in 2024.
And the charges were as severe as it gets. First-degree murder, multiple counts of possessing a firearm during a crime of violence, assault with intent to kill.
And the political signal came straight from the top. Attorney General Pamela Bondi went on record publicly saying she would urge prosecutors to seek the death penalty.
Which tells you everything you need to know. It's a clear signal of their intent to fully federalize this prosecution, to make this case a national symbol.
It was never just about justice for one crime. It was rhetorical framing. It was all designed to support the immigration crackdown that was already waiting in the wings. They successfully framed the tragedy as this, total irreversible failure of the entire asylum system.
But the background of the suspect, Lakhanwal, it introduces this massive contradiction, a paradox that the administration immediately, and I think skillfully, pivoted to use.
It's a fascinating pivot.
Federal findings showed he had previously worked with CIA-backed zero units in Afghanistan. So by previous standards, this was someone who was, a vetted ally.
And that's the whole point. Mm-hmm. Instead of wrestling with the complexity of that, dealing with people from these conflict zones, they used his CIA link to justify a new radical zero trust doctrine.
So their argument became what?
Their argument became, if this guy, who was vetted by our own intelligence agencies because of his background, can still be a lethal threat, then no vetting process is good enough. None of it works.
And by doing that, they just pulled the rug out from under the entire post-2021 evacuation and resettlement system.
Completely. They turned a specific security failure into a universal indictment of the whole architecture.
And the details of the attack itself, they just hammered home this narrative of premeditation.
Yeah, investigators found numerous electronic devices, but the most striking detail, he drove over 2,300 miles.
All the way from Washington State to D.C.
To carry out this attack, I mean, driving across the entire country with that kind of intent, it just screams planned ideological violence.
It does. And the weapon, a .357 Magnum revolver. It's a six-shot handgun.
And he's using it against heavily armed National Guard soldiers. Analysts we spoke to said this strongly implies a suicide mission.
He didn't plan to survive.
No, the plan was to be a martyr. That calculated nature solidifies the federal case for premeditation and, you know, likely future terrorism charges, whether they're officially filed or not. The government has already fully used that narrative, a calculated ideological attack.
Which brings us to the other half of this. The narrative of war and security was reinforced, literally, by the transformation of the military.
The physical and conceptual militarization that happened on the very same day. It's incredible.
The rebranding of the Pentagon. It was finalized. The Department of War.
Yeah, and this wasn't some quiet bureaucratic name change. They installed new heavy bronze plaques right at the Pentagon entrances. It's a profound act of, like, psychological and rhetorical conditioning for the institution and for the public.
It signals a whole new posture. The new Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, he said it was meant to sharpen the focus on our willingness to wage war.
And that willingness, as we saw almost immediately, is now being directed right here on American streets.
Hegseth authorized 500 more National Guard troops for D.C. right away.
But it's not the number. As you said, it's a tactical shift. The operational concept is what matters here.
The directive. It mandated high visibility patrols, where Guard members would be paired directly with MPD officers, the Metropolitan Police Department.
This isn't just backup. This isn't logistical support. This is the military being operationally inserted into civilian policing.
It's a huge development. I mean, it's effectively deputizing soldiers as beat cops. It just completely blurs the lines of domestic security.
And it immediately brings up the question of the Posse Comitatus Act.
Right. The act that's supposed to prevent exactly this. It limits the use of the military for domestic law enforcement. So how are they justifying this?
It's a textbook bypass. They're using the unique legal status of the D.C. National Guard,
which reports directly to the president.
Exactly. Unlike state guards that report to a governor, the D.C. Guard reports to the president. And that direct chain of command lets him deploy them for domestic duties without triggering the strict limits of Posse Comitatus,
yeah,
which mostly applies to the active duty federal military.
So it's a legal workaround that aligns perfectly with their goal of federalizing and militarizing security.
In D.C. first, and then as a model for major cities nationwide. You have the ideological justification from the tragedy and the apparatus, the Department of War, immediately deployed at home.
And that sets the stage perfectly for the next pillar, the radical immigration policy reset that just rolled out right behind it.
This is where we see the administration's core philosophy in action. It's the unilateral dismantling of asylum and visa processes, all done under the emotional cover of the DC attack.
It started with the ideological framework. The president's declaration of intent to permanently pause migration from all third world countries.
We have to talk about that term, third world.
It's archaic.
It's deliberately archaic. I mean, it's been discarded in modern diplomacy for decades. By resurrecting it, the administration's signaling a return to, like, a Cold War era binary.
A hierarchy.
A hierarchy based not on economics, but on perceived cultural and civilizational compatibility with their definition of America. It's an explicit signal of isolationism based on culture.
And tied to that rhetoric, they introduced this chilling new federal term, reverse migration.
Mm-hmm.
What does that actually mean? It sounds ominous.
It is, because it goes so far beyond just deporting people who are here illegally. Reverse migration suggests a systematic, sustained effort to reduce the total foreign-born population. That includes people who are currently residing here legally.
So it's not about managing the flow of people coming in anymore. It's about actively reducing the population that's already here.
The existing stock, yes.
That's a staggering shift. How do you even begin to implement that? Which brings us to the key policy mechanism they rolled out, the net asset test.
This might be the single most impactful policy of the day. The administration stated they would, and I'm quoting, remove anyone who is not a net asset to the United States. Hmm. And they're ending federal benefits for non-citizens.
So wait, this isn't just about new applicants. How does this affect someone who's had a green card for, say, 10 or 15 years?
That's the radical part. Hmm. A green card, legal permanent residency, has always implied stability. But this new policy suggests a retroactive application of the public charge rule. Meaning, if a legal permanent resident, at any point during their years here, use certain federal benefits, maybe food assistance, housing support, certain kinds of subsidized health care, they could now be retroactively deemed a public charge.
And therefore not a net asset.
Not a net asset. And that could potentially strip them of their LPR status.
So a green card is no longer a document of permanent residency. It's now what? A conditional permit subject to ongoing economic performance reviews?
The stability is gone.
Yes.
It introduces massive legal instability for millions of people. And we're already seeing this applied. The directive mandated a full-scale, rigorous reexamination of green cards and immigration status for nationals from 19 specific countries of concern.
And we know that list includes places like Afghanistan, obviously, but also Haiti, Venezuela, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Cuba. And even Turkmenistan was mentioned.
It's a tremendously wide net. It shows this is about a broader isolationism, not just a reaction to one attack.
And that widening net immediately smashed into the federal bureaucracy. It triggered parallel actions at two key agencies, USCIS, which handles asylum.
And the State Department, which handles visas.
So let's look at the total asylum freeze, the one executed by USCIS Director Joseph Edlow. What was the exact instruction given to asylum officers?
It was incredibly precise and sweeping. All asylum officers were told to refrain from approving, denying, or closing asylum applications, effective immediately.
The key word there is closing. By including administrative closures, they locked down everything.
By halting approvals, denials, and closures, the agency just ceased to function as a decision-making body. It's paralysis by design. It traps hundreds of thousands of applicants in this indefinite legal limbo.
They can't get protection to start a new life, but they also can't get a denial, which would at least let them start their appeals process.
They're just stuck. And the justification they gave was that the halt was needed to vet every single alien to the maximum degree possible.
That sounds like an impossible standard.
It is an impossible standard. It's proving a negative. Proving with absolute certainty that someone poses no future threat. Given that the asylum backlog was already over 1 million cases before this, legal analysts are all saying the same thing.
This isn't a temporary pause?
No. It's a strategic move to create a crisis so huge that it necessitates a legislative overhaul to just break the asylum system entirely. They're choking the administrative process to force Congress to act.
And at the same time, the State Department did its own thing, the Afghan passport ban.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio executed a global halt on visa issuance for, and this was capitalized in the memo, all individuals traveling on Afghan passports.
Directly linking it to the D.C. shooter's nationality.
Explicitly.
Yeah.
And the capitalization of vial is the critical detail. It means no exceptions. Not for the SIVs who worked with U.S. troops, not for diplomats, not for humanitarian parole cases. No one.
That's just collective punishment.
It is. It's based on nationality, not individual risk. And it drew immediate condemnation from groups like hashtag Afghanivac. But more than that, it creates a huge diplomatic crisis for our allies.
For countries like Pakistan, Germany, Qatar.
All the places hosting huge numbers of Afghan refugees who are in the pipeline being vetted for U.S. entry. That pipeline is now completely severed. It leaves our allies scrambling.
Okay, so on November 28th, we have a tragedy weaponized to implement population reduction, capital militarization, and a bureaucratic shutdown of asylum and visas. And yet, the coordination went even further into higher education.
That's the third pillar. And if you thought the federal government's reach was just at the borders and in defense, this part of the story shows their profound new assertion of control over our universities.
So let's look at the mechanism. Aggressive civil rights enforcement. And the target was a major private institution, Northwestern University.
A landmark settlement. And it was a highly visible, coordinated move. The DOJ, the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, and HHS all announced a joint action.
And what were they investigating?
Two things. Allegations of pervasive anti-Semitism on campus and discriminatory hiring practices, specifically citing preference based on race.
The financial deterrent here was massive. It just set an immediate and very painful precedent. Northwestern has to pay $75 million to the U.S. Treasury.
And that figure is orders of magnitude larger than any previous OCR penalty. In the past, penalties were about fixing the problem, not huge punitive fines. This $75 million payment sends a message to every other university president.
And the message is what?
Compliance is not negotiable, and the cost of noncompliance is existential.
But the fine is almost secondary to the ideological compliance mechanisms that are baked into the agreement.
Oh, absolutely. The settlement terms force a deep structural shift in how the university is governed. It essentially enforces a colorblind mandate that, for all practical purposes, outlaws affirmative action and DEI initiatives.
So specifically, Northwestern has to strictly adhere to laws that prohibit preference based on race, color, or national origin in admissions and in hiring.
Which forces them to adopt facially neutral criteria. It's a direct victory for the groups that have been pushing to dismantle DEI nationwide. And on top of that, the agreement mandates specific policies on anti-Semitism.
Right. Mandatory anti-Semitism training for everyone, students, faculty, staff. And it requires clear policies on protests. This is where the federal government steps directly into policing campus speech.
It does. It categorizes certain forms of anti-Zionist protest and rhetoric as creating a hostile educational environment. By setting that standard federally, it forces hundreds of other universities that rely on federal money to adopt similar restrictive policies to avoid getting hit with the same kind of investigation.
But the most intrusive part, what legal experts are calling the Sword of Damocles Clause, is the personal liability.
This is truly unprecedented in federal oversight of higher ed. The university president and the chair of the board of trustees have to personally certify compliance with this whole agreement.
And they have to do it every quarter.
Under penalty of perjury.
So it pierces the corporate veil of the university. If there's a violation and they sign off saying they're compliant, they are personally facing federal perjury charges. A felony.
The implication is immediate and profound. University leaders will no longer tolerate any ambiguity. To avoid personal legal jeopardy, they will aggressively self-police. They will almost certainly overcomply, shutting down any campus activity that could even remotely be seen as violating the agreement.
And in exchange for submitting to this total federal governance overhaul, what did Northwestern get?
The government agreed to restore the university's eligibility for federal grants and contracts.
Which is worth hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
Easily. It's the power of the purse in its purest form.
Right.
The administration is using federal funding as a weapon to force compliance and control academia. Institutional autonomy is the price.
So we've hit the immigration freeze, the capital militarization, the academic crackdown. The sheer breadth of this suggests a global scale of operations, which brings us to the Department of War's global posture and the Genesis mission.
Yeah, the Department of War is very clearly defining its new aggressive posture. And it started with a strategic pivot to nearshore security,
yeah,
right in the Caribbean.
Secretary Hegseth's visit to the Dominican Republic, he got a critical agreement with President Luis Abinader, U.S. military access to two key locations.
San Ysidro Air Base and Las Americas International Airport.
Now, this was publicly framed as a counter-narcotics mission.
It was. But the military assets they're deploying tell a much bigger story. The agreement includes the immediate deployment of KC-135 tanker aircraft.
Tankers are all about reach and endurance. They're force multipliers. They extend the range of fighters, surveillance planes, drones.
Exactly. This isn't about chasing drug boats. This deployment signals the establishment of a persistent, long-term air dominance capability in the Caribbean basin.
And that serves two goals.
Two critical, interconnected goals. First, it counters the growing influence of China and Russia in the Western Hemisphere. And second, it serves the administration's goal of hardening what they call the nation's third border, the maritime approaches to the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean.
November 28th was also a key date for the defense industrial base, especially regarding Ukraine.
Yeah, we noted the estimated completion date for that huge $1.2 billion Raytheon NASAMS contract for Ukraine.
The air defense systems.
Right. And the physical delivery of that much hardware. It creates a very clear decision point for the administration.
So do they immediately renew support with another massive contract, or do they pivot?
And given that we've been hearing whispers from the White House about peace talks in Geneva, the timing is interesting. The conclusion of this contract could be strategically timed to precede a big diplomatic push to freeze or de-escalate the conflict. The ability to supply high-end air defense is a negotiating chip.
And a chip that has now maybe been played?
Potentially. And closer to home, on continental defense, we saw the conclusion of the counter-uncrewed aircraft system trials in Ottawa, the CUAS sandbox.
So anti-drone tech.
Anti-drone tech, but specifically for urban environments. As these small asymmetric drone attacks become a primary threat, this exercise ensures the U.S. and Canada can work together to defend North American cities.
And on the less glamorous side, there was also a $90 million contract concluded for hazardous, toxic, and radioactive waste services.
It sounds dry, but those contracts are absolutely essential. They're what keep the country's core infrastructure running, cleaning up military bases, nuclear sites. It shows that the long-term maintenance of the state is still happening, even during all these dramatic policy shifts.
Okay, now we have to turn to what might be the most significant long-term policy move of the day, the continued systematic rollout of the Genesis mission for artificial intelligence.
This is a total mobilization of national resources. They are explicitly framing the Genesis mission as being on the same scale as the Manhattan Project.
A whole-of-government commitment to establishing technological supremacy in AI.
And the structure of the mission is key. It centralizes control within the Department of Energy and its national labs. It's deliberately bypassing traditional AI centers like the NSF or even the Merkel sector.
Why the DOE?
Because they're classifying AI strictly as a national security asset and an instrument of industrial policy, not just a scientific pursuit. The DOE has immense computational power, and critically, it has unparalleled proprietary federal data sets.
Which brings us to this idea of data nationalization.
That's the core of it. The mission is creating an integrated AI platform designed to ingest massive volumes of federal data, geological surveys, medical histories, classified defense information. The government is leveraging its unique data assets, which the private sector can't legally access, to train its own proprietary foundation models.
So the private sector simply can't compete.
They can't. Not with this depth and security clearance of data.
Yeah.
And the strategic focus areas are very specific. Nuclear fusion, critical materials, and biotechnology.
Which align perfectly with their goals of energy dominance and supply chain independence.
Exactly. They plan to use this state-controlled AI to accelerate material science, break dependence on foreign minerals, get fusion research closer to commercial reality, and secure leadership in biotech. The Genesis mission is their most advanced industrial policy, and it's being executed at speed.
It's clear the executive branch is building tools for long-term power. But all these aggressive actions, they need legal cover, and they have economic consequences. We need to look at the judicial and economic landscape of November 28th.
And we saw two key judicial developments that really just reinforced the legitimacy of the whole agenda.
The first was a pivotal ruling in D.C. District Court. Judge Trevor McFadden dismissed a lawsuit against the EEOC.
The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, right. The suit was about the EEOC stopping its disparate impact investigations.
And that's a huge deal for the administration's regulatory strategy.
It's monumental. Disparate impact rules are what force agencies to investigate policies that might seem neutral, but end up harming protected groups. By dismissing the lawsuit, Judge McFadden confirmed a core tenet of executive power. Courts cannot police the executive branch's enforcement priorities.
So if the administration just decides not to enforce a regulation, say an environmental rule, the courts can't force them to.
That's what the ruling says. It gives them broad legal cover for a strategy of selective non-enforcement. They can hyper-enforce the rules they like the civil rights actions against universities, and just ignore the ones they don't.
It validates the unitary executive theory.
100%. It says the president has absolute, unreviewable control over how federal laws are enforced.
And the second judicial point was the Supreme Court showing, as you put it, strategic patience.
They deferred a ruling on a major case about the president's power to fire the heads of independent agencies, like the FTC. They kicked the can down the road.
And how does that help the administration now?
It's a gift. It lets them continue their administrative purge in the meantime. Without a clear ruling limiting the president's removal power, they have maximum flexibility to install loyalists in key positions while the issue is tabled by the highest court.
So the legal path was cleared, but what's the economic cost of all this? Let's look at the shockwaves from the reverse migration policy.
Well, analysts immediately started running the numbers, and the economic models are projecting a sharp contraction in labor growth.
How sharp? What are the numbers?
The low migration scenario could reduce civilian workforce growth by millions. Some are saying up to 3 million people through 2028. That's a direct and measurable threat to GDP growth. it could shave significant percentage points off economic expansion.
It really highlights the tension between, you know, populist immigration restrictions and the labor needs of a capitalist economy. Which sectors are going to be hit the hardest?
The ones that are heavily reliant on immigrant labor.
Yes.
So agriculture, construction, hospitality, essential services. Analysts are predicting immediate wage inflation and structural stress on supply chains if the workforce contracts that much.
It's an economic policy goal that seems directly at odds with the goal of GDP growth.
Completely at odds.
And yet, November 28th was Black Friday, which gave us this real-time indicator of consumer sentiment that seemed to tell a totally different story.
That's the fascinating split. I mean, despite the security lockdown in D.C. and the grim national mood, retail spending was surprisingly robust. Consumers were spending heavily, especially on experience-based retail.
So it's a bifurcated economy. On one hand, you have strong consumer demand. On the other, you have these mounting, self-inflicted structural risks, labor shortages, now intentional population reduction, just gathering on the supply side.
It creates a dangerous cognitive dissonance for the public. Mm-hmm. Your immediate consumer experience feels positive. You can still buy what you want. And that masks the fact that the underlying foundations of the economy are being intentionally undermined.
Okay, we need to shift to the broader political debates and contextual news that were framing all of this.
The DC shooting was a profound catalyst. It just immediately deepened the partisan chasm.
Republican leadership unified instantly, completely behind the administration's interpretation. They framed the shooting not as a general violence issue, but explicitly as an immigration and vetting failure.
And they pinned it directly on the previous administration's policies. They used the tragedy of Specialist Beckstrom's death to push hard for more border wall funding and stricter asylum laws.
And the speed of that messaging was effective. Democratic leaders were put completely on the defensive. They condemned the violence, but they struggled to counter that dominant narrative blaming failed vetting.
They were just flat-footed. The executive branch moved too fast.
And this highly charged climate brings the volatile young voter calculus back into focus.
Yeah, political analysts were quick to note that young male voters, a group that surprisingly skewed Republican in 2024, partly over economics and affordability.
And the toxic masculinity messaging.
Right. That group is now considered back in play by both sides.
What makes them so volatile?
They're looking for tangible results, not just ideology. If the current administration fails to deliver on substantive economic policies, especially things like housing and education affordability, those voters could easily pivot away again. Their loyalty is transactional.
And beyond the partisan fighting, another threat emerged, one that affects farmers, small businesses, a multi-billion dollar industry, the possible hemp ban.
This news gained a lot of traction late on Friday. Reports indicated a comprehensive hemp ban was tucked into the government reopening bill.
The must-pass bill to avoid a shutdown.
Exactly. And it spurred immediate, bipartisan, furious lobbying to stop it. The industry is warning that this could wipe out 95% of the federally legal THC beverage industry. Brands like Kite Soda.
The supporters of the ban, people like Texas LT Gov Dan Patrick, are using safety and morality arguments. They're saying it will save a generation from getting hooked on dangerous drugs.
They are. And they're citing concerns from officials, like the Minnesota AG, about synthetic, highly intoxicating THC being marketed to minors. They're arguing this regulatory loophole is a public health disaster.
But the industry's defense is fierce. What's their counterargument?
They argue that the dangerous drugs rhetoric is based on obsolete, early 20th century anti-immigrant propaganda. They point out the hypocrisy.
Which is?
The ban targets hemp products, but the alcohol industry, which markets highly flavored drinks that appeal to minors, faces no similar existential threat.
So they're saying it's not about safety, it's about selective prohibition against a new competitor.
That's their position. They're arguing for education, rigorous testing, and sensible taxation, not a total ban.
Finally, we have to look beyond our borders one last time to get context for the Department of War's posture, especially on Ukraine. We have this powerful personal account from a family in Kharkiv.
It's the story of three generations of women. They initially fled Kharkiv for the Czech Republic, but they've returned.
They went back into a war zone. Why?
Well, because despite the safety, they couldn't sustain life there. The cost of living, the inability to work, it forced them back home.
And what's the reality of living there now?
They describe it as living on a bomb, continuous unpredictable rocket strikes. The psychological stress affects everyone. Even their pets are constantly nervous, always hiding.
It's a state of perpetual fear.
Mm-hmm. And their apartment was hit after they returned. windows blown out. But the deepest challenge is the mental state. There's this profound lack of hope for any definitive end to the war.
Which led them to discuss the most difficult dilemma, the price of peace.
Yes. They talked about the grim possibility that any future peace deal might require surrendering territory to Russia, potentially their homes, parts of their city.
And what was the collective feeling about that?
It was heartbreaking. They want peace. They want to remain Ukrainian. But the immediate, overwhelming desire to just end the continuous conflict, it's overriding everything else. Even if the sacrifice of territory is immense.
It just underlines the brutal cost of this conflict. And it provides a crucial emotional context for the American policy decisions being made about that NASAMS contract and any peace talks in Geneva.
It reminds you that policy is not abstract. The end of a defense contract here has devastating immediate implications for people on the ground over there.
So as we step back from this 24-hour frenzy, it's critical to synthesize it. What does the coordination of all these activities tell us about where the U.S. federal government is headed?
I think this day, November 28th, 2025, stands as a historic demarcation line. What we saw was a fully coordinated effort, paralyzing the asylum system, militarizing the capital, coercing a university into abandoning its core policies under personal legal threat.
Expanding military basing in the Caribbean.
And centralizing all critical AI innovation as a state security asset under the Genesis mission.
This wasn't chaos. It wasn't disjointed. It was the calculated simultaneous execution of a single coherent governing philosophy.
That philosophy is crystal clear. It prioritizes sovereignty over humanitarianism. It prioritizes security over civil liberty. And most critically, it prioritizes executive power over legislative consensus. The new Department of War isn't just a name on a plaque.
It's the operating logic of the American administrative state.
Manifesting in domestic security, immigration, global posture, and even in our universities.
So what does this aggressive centralization of power mean for the long term? I mean, if the federal government has consolidated control over enforcement through the courts, centralized data through the Genesis mission, and established a mechanism for domestic military deployment.
Then this raises a really important question for you, the listener, to consider. If the administrative state is now technologically empowered by AI, legally validated by a deferential judiciary, and domestically militarized, what are the inevitable long-term civil liberty implications of this new technologically enabled aggressive model of governance? How far will the boundaries of executive authority extend before new checks are found?
That is a profoundly challenging question to leave with. Sam Kennedy, thank you for guiding us through this exhaustive deep dive into the federal actions of November 28, 2025.
My pleasure, Alex Johnson. Thank you.